At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is, as always, the hype machine, Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
Fantastic, Mark. How are you doing this week?
I'm doing very well. I am your prophet of rage, Mark Bigney, and we are going to be talking about board games. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then our feature game, which is Andromeda's Edge. I have one or two things to say about Andromeda's Edge, the spiritual successor to Dwellings of Eldervale by Luke Laurie and Maximus Laurie. So with that in mind, let us proceed. Walker, what did you play this week?
Mark, once again, playing Harmonies. I'm not going to go on about it. Just
too late.
The fact that we're still playing it, that I'm still playing it, means something. So there it is. Harmonies, designed by Johan Bevnido and put out by Liblid. It's a great... Let's play two players. We have 20 minutes until the other people showed up. Got a whole game in, no problem, 20 minutes. Great little sort of, you have your cards, you make your little biomes, you get to intermingle them and do this really cool spatial puzzle while still trying to plan out an overall rivers and mountains and trees. Anyway, Harmonies.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to trying it again. Didn't quite... make me obsessed the way it has you, though.
Obsessed. For what it does.
Are you still talking about it? This is obsessive behavior, Walker.
It gives you great choices, easy to teach, all in a 20-minute window.
Wait, is that a new facial tattoo that says, I love Harmonies?
It's not.
I think there may be a problem.
No, it's all good.
Yeah, Harmonies is great fun. Very much an iterative improvement over the legion of nature-themed drafting tile layers that we've had. Not that I object. Most of them have been perfectly pleasant. Played another game of Dropolter. This is the absurd dexterity game by Paul Schultz and Oik Games, where in the tiny box you have your little talismanic bits of juju and other kinds of fetishes that are necessary to ward off spirits, because that is, of course, what you put in your bedside table.
I was about to say, I like having the extra set, right? I have my normal set that's beside my bed.
The one passed down from your family,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And then you have the one that comes in the game. So it's, you know,
yeah,
you
it's
mix
not
it
quite
up.
As potent, but it still works. Just, I mean, the ghosts respect the effort, right? Because if you show up and you don't have anything to throw at their feet, you have no sacred wafers to hurl at them, then it's just embarrassing.
Not prepared.
And then the ghost is like, what am I even doing here? It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
So Dropolter is a game about selective dropping. You have these five ridiculous objects in your hand and you have to drop specifically the ones you want. And I thought I'd figured something out, Walker. I thought I was being clever. This is an indication of the kind of stresses that you have in a real-time competitive game like Dropolter. You're supposed to drop a specific combination of objects. There are five available objects. I saw on the card that wanted four objects, and I figure, okay. You can do process of elimination on pattern recognition. You've played Ghost Blitz before. The one that's missing here is the ring. I need to drop everything but the ring. I grip the ring with the thumb of my hand, and then I just upend the rest of my hand.
Very clever.
Losing all my points. Because, of course, when you
get... You had bells, too?
Yeah, I had bells. Whenever you win a round, you get a bell, and that's how you win the game. But it goes into your hand, and if you drop the bell, you've dropped the bell. We had to initiate a house rule that, yes, Walker is now openly mocking me. We had to initiate a house rule that if you drop the bell between rounds, you get to take it back. Because at one point, someone made a hand gesture while explaining something and a bell went flying. So we were able to recover the bell.
I wanted to be there when just the moment of clarity came to you of what just happened.
I was just looking. Well, I did win the round. I won that round real well. Just with a great deal of misery. I also dropped bells when you've successfully dropped what you're supposed to drop. You're supposed to grab that large wooden ghost meeple that's in the middle of the table. Another thing that I kept needing to remind myself was, don't grab the ghost meeple with the hand holding all your objects. Yeah, I lost a bell that way, too.
That's a good rule. Good rule.
Well, it's just I'd internalized that you're playing with one hand.
Yeah.
And so, very much like a stereotype of the martial arts master, like Oro from Street Fighter 3, that's a deep cut, what we call, I was playing as though I had one arm bound. But there you go. Dropholder is marvelous. We also had to combat environmental difficulties, but at least everyone was playing that way. Anyone who's grown up or in and around the East Coast can tell you that late September starts rolling around. The thermostat may say only something like, 18 to 20 degrees, but the humidity is 105%.
Sticky range.
Oh, yes. And so consequently, we were all dealing with very sweaty hands, having to drop the necessary objects. It's glorious. Dropholter is wonderful. I wish it were in wider availability. The copy that we have is, shall we say, borrowed. I'm hoping that the person I borrowed it from just never remembers.
Forgets, yeah.
Just forgets. I've done that with books. Clearly it all shakes out, right? If I've had people walk off with things that they borrowed from me, not this individual, but others, and I do that to him, it'll all work itself out.
Shakes out in the end.
Yeah, I studied ethics. I'm
but
sure it
came from somewhere, so obviously it's going to apply to this situation.
Well, yeah, it came from somewhere, and it is somewhere now, so it hasn't moved.
And when you get stuff, it shakes out. In the end.
There you go.
It's all part and parcel.
Thank you for joining my TED Talk. That is Dropholter by Paul Schultz and Oink Games. Marvelous dexterity game. Highly recommended, whether or not you are in OT.
Got Rise and Fall back to the table. This was a crowdfunding project. We streamed it, so if you want to take a look at it, come to the live channel. This is put out by Ludicali, designed by Christoph Bollinger. And it's a little bit like Barony, where it's very much... you're blocking stuff on the map. This gorgeous map, because it's like four different levels of, water, grass, mountain,
trees. It is very striking.
You build this giant map, and we played with a full four players. So this map was busy, because you're constantly trying to get units out, because that's how you get all the trophies, is getting all the units of a certain type out. And so you're getting out cities, you're getting out settlers. What are they called? Nomads. Sorry, nomads. I keep calling them settlers.
I mean, they do settle.
They do.
They settle more than they roam, so.
It's a great game. We played with, our first game, there wasn't many temples, which converts other units. It's pretty well the only sort of like deep player interaction. You're actually destroying a unit and replacing it with your elves, so it's even worse than combat in a way. We didn't have much in our first game. This second game, it was, I wouldn't want to say more relevant. It didn't happen. And too much, but the threat.
Yeah.
Because we played with player powers. One player had their temples had double the range.
Oh my.
So it was
that's wild.
Twice as large for their temples. Another player had a mind flare looking character, which unfortunately threw a wrench in the whole system because you couldn't convert any of their units.
Oh my. Oh, I hate it when powers interact that way.
So not 100% sold on. I believe the person that couldn't be controlled had 200 points, whereas another player had 30 points.
Ah.
So the swing in this game
that's a swing.
Way off, and the player power seemed off as well. They do it in an odd way as well. You deal out three cards to every player. You get to choose one, and then you put one down to the right, to the right.
Draft,
so you have two in front of you by the end of the game.
Oh, okay.
No, you don't draft. That's just it.
Oh, wow.
You get two powers. They both apply.
Now... how was it presented in the rules? As an optional module? As the advanced version? How is it framed?
No, it's definitely a module. And
okay.
And they do it. I like how they do that. There's like 23 modules. This not being one of them. This is like totally separate.
I see.
And then on top of this, there's 23 other modules. And they give you a deck for all the modules. So you could just shuffle them up and deal out one if you wanted, or
right,
as many as you wanted. And we went through a bunch. We were thinking about putting a dragon in or a sea serpent or something, but we didn't. We just ended up just saying, let's just deal with
the
player
powers.
Yeah,
you don't get a dragon on a whim.
Exactly.
That's like, who's going to walk it?
We sort of, I almost wish we had, because what the dragon does, it sort of goes from top of mountain to top of mountain, destroying units around it.
Okay.
And I sort of wish we had done that, because much like our first game where we had this lake that was just a bit too big, in this game we had a mountain that was just a bit too big.
Sure.
And so it scored a ton of points at the end. Anyway, I'm still very much enjoying Rise and Fall and will play it anytime.
I'm always dubious when there's a whole bunch of modules and I feel like it's not framed properly. But in the, I wish I could sometimes just sit the designer down and say, come on, what's the real way to play? Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you have pressures from crowdfunding. I know you've got pressures from market expectations. I know you've got pressures from the publisher.
You want to fill the box.
You got to fill that box. What's the real way to play? On a scale of 1 to 10, how confident are you in all these modules?
On a scale of 1 to 23.
Yeah, just pick a number at random. Absolutely. Yeah, so it felt a little bit less like a blunt efficiency puzzle with all the blocking and getting in people's way.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of blocking in this one.
Okay, yeah.
Especially with 4. There was like sort of like just, there were very distinct valleys to get to a larger lake. And so once a temple was sort of placed at that opening, it was sort of like, well, I guess we're not going to try to, you know, put a boat out there. Because as soon as you moved a nomad in, it would almost assuredly get converted. So you sort of had to time it. It's like, oh, he just played his temple. Okay, now, you know, quickly play the nomad card and get in there. And
well, but the person with the temple, that was one of the only things that I found interesting about Rise and Fall. I played again, but I found it just a blunt efficiency puzzle the way we played. If somebody's got built a temple as a threat, on the one hand, yes, they get to threaten and lock down that area of the terrain. But on the other hand, they have this card that they have to play every cycle that's not doing them any favors. And so if people do stay away from the temple, they've got effectively a dead card. That's what happened in the one game I played in Rise and Fall. I built a temple, thought I was being clever. It's like, oh, experiment with new buildings. It's like, wait a minute, now I'm stuck with this thing. And then when the next decline happened, I buried the temple and never looked back.
And the decline was a little more, meant something this time, because money wasn't flowing as much as it did in our first game.
Sure.
So it was much more of a penalty to get cards back. There was actually decisions being made on which cards, because there was a round where 2 trophies were claimed.
Woof.
So now we had to get rid of 2 cards, and then we all did sort of a round of, okay, well, we get rid of almost everything but our ships, and then we do a round of taxing with the ships, and then that round we all get to buy back a card, and then the game sort of started up again. It was kind of interesting the way the 2 games were different, that's for sure. And that's Rise and Fall.
On the topic of things not necessarily interacting with each other very well, possibly as a consequence of crowdfunding, played another game of Planet Unknowns by Ryan Lambert and Adam Rayberg by Adam's Apple Games. There is an expansion that's going to be coming out soon-ish, I suppose. And Planet Unknown has a number of bits that I think are very solid and interesting. And then there are bits that don't necessarily cohere. So the bits that are solid and interesting is that, I mean, well, first of all, it's got a lazy Susan, which is excellent. Susan is presented as an acronym or an initialism, but I have yet to hear it explained to me what they are. I love stupid acronyms. It is one of my favorite things in life. And so I'm very curious to know if anybody knows what the Susan in the lazy Susan means to say.
Well, in the kitchen, in the theme of kitchen, you know, things that help you in the kitchen, I learned that Tupperware went into bankruptcy this week.
Oh.
Which is crazy.
Well, their distribution model is relied on an antiquated set of social gatherings that probably went the way of the dodo when the pandemic hit.
And those that watch sort of reels or videos, you've seen like the new trend is nice, clear plastic bins for all your things.
Yep.
There's like this new, like what they call it, fridge-scaping. Where you like put
fridge scaping.
Yes, you actually put little flower arrangements in your fridge and you make everything all neat.
Interesting.
And it's all clear bins, where that is definitely not the Tupperware model. It's all, you know, solid, bright colors.
Sorry, I entered a brief fugue state. What's this podcast about?
Preserving food?
Anyway. So Planet Unknown is a polyomino game where you draft from the Lazy Susan, and everyone loves the Lazy Susan. It wins friends wherever it goes.
It's true.
Whether or not people engage in, I think, the borderline intolerable actions of Chip the Third of using the Lazy Susan to randomize every round
when he's
in control because he refuses to make a decision. Anyway, setting that aside. And I've yet to encounter a polyomino game that I strongly disliked. And Planet Unknown is one of my preferred ones, both in terms of aesthetics and in terms of just the joy of manipulating the Lazy Susan. And the other thing that I really like, which are the asymmetric corporations. I don't know if they're balanced. I don't care. They have fun powers. I had a corporation that allowed you to skip over spaces on a track by virtue of things you collect on the board. And it dovetailed nicely with the drafting and various other pressures. Now, one of the things that doesn't cohere is I was reminded once again, we didn't play with them, but the asymmetric planets seem all over the place in terms of some of them just seem strictly advantageous. Some of them just seem strictly burdensome. And I do not understand how they can be used as anything other than a handicapping mechanism for experienced and inexperienced players. If so, fine. But then again, with inexperienced players, you don't tend to want to burden them with more asymmetry and special powers that they need to be concerned about. But on top of that, there's a deck of objective cards. And in the standard way you play, I'm not even going to talk about the events, they're nonsense. But in the standard objectives, you put an objective between every player. So I am competing with an objective to the person to the left and the person on my right. Well, in the initial draw, what happened was there was one objective between Huey and Louie that said, have the most green spaces in one contiguous area. Fine. And there was another objective between myself and another Louie that said had the fewest number of green icons on your board. And it was just fortunate that it didn't happen to land either to the side of Huey or the other Louie, because then the two objectives would have been working across purposes and the other people at the table would not have had objectives working across purposes. Again, I'm not particularly competitively minded, but when a game allows for that degree of laxity in terms of the setup, it just makes me think that things are being done in a sloppy way, and then I just get a little bit irked. Had that deal happened, I would have just binned the card and then drawn another one and proceeded, because it's just...
Or just skipped a space. Well, we'll put that here instead.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so we didn't have to deal with any of those burdens, but I think it's a little bit problematic when inside the box those potential counter indications can occur.
Especially when it's... I'm not going to say it's easy, but you could put A's and B's on cards and... No two A's can be beside each other, or no two B's can be beside each other.
Or even just specify the card. You don't even need to get to that level of generality. You could just get to the level of specificity, but alas. So that is Planet Unknown. Still a fan. Bring it out semi-regularly. Not a huge fan of the expense and how burdensome it is to transport, but you get the payoff in terms of the Lazy Susan, which is great. And that way you don't have to deal with, say, the setup of something like Baron Park. I love Baron Park. Baron Park is thoroughly delightful. The worst part of Baron Park is the setup. And the Lazy Susan at least facilitates with things like that. So I'm looking forward to the expansion. One of those things that's sufficiently expensive and difficult to find. I don't know that I can recommend it too strongly. And there are tons of great polyomino games on the market. It's just Planet Unknown happens to be the one that I have.
So I returned to Undaunted 2200 Callisto because I want to try out the solo game. And I want to go back to what I said last week where I said the solo book was 60 pages. It is 60 pages.
Is it still 60 pages?
It's still 60 pages.
Hasn't grown or shrunk in the interim?
But it also includes all of the scenarios. So individually. So like the actual rules for a scenario isn't as crazy as I made it out to be. That being said, I played it once using the actual solo rules. Going through, there's like a priority for each unit. You draw this unit, you draw like a random initiative card off the top. And if it wins, it gets to keep that card and you have four cards for its turn. And if it loses, then it doesn't get the card. And that was all fine and good, but it seemed like an awful lot of upkeep. Whereas I just thought, well, I'm pretty sure I can play both sides without, stressing too much over whether I'm... Because,
the old-timey wargamey way.
Exactly. I don't care who wins. I just want to enjoy the mechanisms of the game.
Yep.
And therefore, I sort of switch back, which initiative card I choose first. It's like, so I don't... And I would try to do it logically. It's like, well, I definitely want to win this turn. All I have to do is if I have the card I need to win, so I want initiative no matter what. Or I look around, it's like, oh, it really doesn't matter. I definitely just probably... I can't get rid of this interference card anyway, so I'll just... Anyway. I still enjoyed it both ways. I think it would be an interesting way to, check out every scenario and see how they work. I'm definitely looking forward to playing it more this week. Undaunted Callisto. This is designed by Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson and put out by Offspring Games, of which we have a review copy.
Well, no. Have would imply possession. One has been earmarked for us and is possibly in the possession of various postal services. Played another game of Irish Gauge. I was having a discussion with people about the particular sub-element of the hobby known as train gaming, and by which they meant the hardcore 18XX variety of let's just do margin calls for 8 to 12 hours. I'm not making a judgment on this activity, because anytime I do, people get angry. I'm merely observing that it exists. I commented that, if you enjoy 18XX, it is possible that you might enjoy Cube Rails games. They operate on very different parameters, but many people, not just myself, think that Cube Rails games give you some of the interesting elements and the economic manipulations and track laying conditions of an 18XX, and they typically tend to be tight economic games that are very, very, very quick and efficient by any standard, even setting aside comparisons with 18XX. And so I gave them the choice between the Cube Rails games that I had and the crew wanted to play Irish Gage. And so Irish Gage by Emma Bell Holland, published by Capstone Games in 2014. Irish Gage is probably one of the most, I don't know if random is the word I'd use, but it's a little bit strange. The way that it works is all the tiling is, well, cube laying is deliberate. All the economic development is deliberate. All the auctions are deliberate. And the way payouts happen, they don't happen on a schedule, they don't happen at the end of a round, they don't happen after a certain operating sequence. They happen when somebody spends their action to trigger a payout. And which cities will pay out, and by consequence which railways will pay out, is a function of cubes drawn from a bag. So what you need to do is you need to build an advantage in terms of scoring possibilities based on your board position, your stock holdings, and the distribution of cubes left in the bag. You got to count the number of cubes left in the bag. There's only three colors and nine each, so it's not hugely burdensome. Otherwise, what you're going to be doing is spending your precious turn handing more money to somebody else, and that ain't good. On occasion, you might want to risk it, and on occasion, you might have to do it just so you have enough money to protect your interests. If a stock round is going to happen and someone's going to offer something up for auction, you definitely don't want to pass merely by virtue of not having enough cash on hand. And on top of that, Irish Gage is also unusual in that at the end of the game, stock certificates will pay out on a fixed rate. It is the case that each certificate has a minimum bid value that is also what it is going to be worth at the end of the game. So it's not a function of how well the railroad did, as is the case in a number of other railroad games, nor is it the case, like other games, that the value of the certificate is nothing. So it's all, again, it's all about margins. You know, this yellow certificate, the minimum bid is 15, so I have to calculate how much this thing is worth based on the expected return on top of 15, because it's going to be worth at least the 15. I prefer, actually, the sort of calculation involved in Wabash Cannonball. Wabash Cannonball, at the end of the game, your stocks are worthless, so it's all about how much money you want to inject in the treasury versus payouts. Whereas in Irish Gage, the company never pays out money at all. Not for payouts, not for laying track, nothing. All the money comes and goes from the bank. Which, again, works in tandem and to service these other economic elements. I like exploring these other economic models. It's just very strange for a number of those reasons. But all the more reason to go back to it and appreciate its differences. And I've thoroughly enjoyed all the Cube Rails works by Emma Bell Holland. I haven't tried Dual Gage yet. It's very controversial and divisive. But I'm interested to give it a shot. And I was very pleased to observe that the 18XX players, casual as though they may be, nonetheless were able to appreciate some of the interesting economic elements of Irish Gage. This was actually first introduced to me by a listener at Chuck's, may it rest in peace. And I've been very eager to try any and all Cube Rails games for a long time, and Irish Gage was no exception. And I just really like how you get these fascinating economic models. You've played, Walker, Wabash Cannonball. You've also played Iberian Gage. And my understanding is that you, too, are similarly curious about the cubes and the rails.
I am.
Yeah, yeah.
They've all played very well so far. That's Irish Gage.
That is Irish Gage.
I'm sure I've played games with my mother when I was a child. In fact, a memory of an attempt at Colet's Castle where my father blew up about the fact that someone had to play Nazis, and I don't think it went very well after that.
Sure.
That's the memory I have so far. But that being said, I got to play a game with my mother this week. We played Jekyll versus Hyde. This is a trick-taking game, and I picked this one because I didn't have to go over trick-taking with her. Because she plays bridge, I knew we grew up playing euchre all the time. Not that trick-taking is hard to teach. The nuances of trick-taking is extremely hard to teach.
Yes.
And so she already had that, so that's why I chose Jekyll versus Hyde. And we eventually did get up to a full game. I decided to break it down into two parts, because in Jekyll and Hyde, they have a very interesting way to sort of set trump. They only have three suits in Jekyll versus Hyde, and the first time that a color comes out, that's the lowest rank of card.
You only need three suits because it's one guy.
One guy.
Right. There's Jekyll and Hyde, but it's one guy, and they only need one suit at a time, so three is fine.
I don't know. You get bigger when, yeah.
Oh, that's a good point. You're good. Right. Oh, they're not the same size.
And then you have that third one for when, you know, they rip. in between. So you need extra. Yeah.
Spare suit.
Just so. It's very interesting. Jekyll wants both players to win and or lose the same number of tricks. Because you're going to look at the difference of who won most or least. Hyde wants it a huge swing. Either Hyde wants to lose all of his tricks or win all of the tricks. Because there is this little pawn that moves across the board. And by the time three rounds are over, Hyde wants it to move right off the board. And Jekyll just wants to hang on for those three rounds and not have it move off. On top of that, there's this interesting potion mechanism. That when a potion is played, and depending on what the other player plays, it makes a potion of that color. And they all do special abilities like clearing the trump rank, or you have to switch cards, or you get to steal a trick. Crazy rules. Looking forward to the next visit where we're going to play a full game. Jekyll versus Hyde, designed by Janali, and put out by Mandu Games. There's like a whole trio of games. There's one I also just got, Scotland Yard, which uses almost identical rules, except you're playing cooperatively against sort of like a random deck of Scotland Yard cards. So I want to give that a try as well. Also picked up Dracula versus Van Helsing, which is, it uses the same sort of trump mechanism with the tokens, but has a sort of completely different setting up a row of cards to beat all these different territories. So I would definitely want to try all these games out. Looking forward to it.
It is a good time to like trick-taking games. There's no shortage of them. There's been a huge explosion of co-op and or two-player trick-taking games over the past few years. I remember when people were stuck with Mew.
Yes. Ugh. For so long.
For a very long time,
not that it was terrible. There were so many different games. Some of them were interesting.
Yeah, no, there were interesting hobbyist trick-taking games before. I mean, Bargain Hunter was originally published in 1999. So it's not as it's just there was this period after the turn of the century where there were just these incredibly broke, burdensome, strange bidding conditions, and they were just getting very, very abstruse. Whereas the ones now, they focus a lot of the complexity on the implications of your actions, not what you want to do in the first place. So I would rather take Ghosts of Christmas, which I completely cannot understand the game state of at any given time, over something like Mew, but at least I know what I'm doing moment to moment in Ghosts of Christmas.
True, but Chris Warren Mew had like several different games in the box, did it not? I thought it was...
Well, there was Mew and more. There was Mew and lots more. There were several packages.
Oh, gotcha.
Like Black Panther was much simpler. Niet was simpler. They weren't all as bad as Mew. And to be frank, during those rare moments of clarity, when I was focusing all my attention and summoning more energy than I've devoted towards any other project in my life, I could glimpse at what was going on in Mew, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself during those moments. And then I would immediately remember that I was something basic, like I was a corporeal intelligence or something like that, and then it would all just fall apart.
I could see that.
So we had a discussion about Gaming Lacuna, and it was announced, much to my shock and surprise, that Warm Boy, who is a very experienced hobbyist gamer, had not played Through the Desert. I was shocked.
Nor has he played Raw, so that's why we removed him from the canon, and why you will not hear from him ever.
No,
Walker, sorry.
I have an unearned reputation, and when you make comments like that, people are going to think that I am some sort of a gatekeeper.
What?
I am not a gatekeeper.
No.
I am a welcoming person. I'm just not an evangelist. I was just surprised, given his patterns of gaming. This was not a surprise, or this was not a disappointment. This was not a reflection on his character. I just would have expected, given his past experiences, for him to have done such a thing. Anyway, you're trying to make me look bad. You're trying to get me in trouble.
You're doing a pretty good job on your own.
Oh, come on. I have no support from anyone here. So... upon hearing this, Dewey said, let's play Through the Desert. And so
Dewey said, I as well have not played Through the Desert.
That didn't surprise me at all.
True.
Right. I have a very high opinion of Dewey. I just would have expected that Warm Boy had. And now, frankly, of the group of people, Warm Boy and Dewey, Dewey is the one who has played Through the Desert and Warm Boy has not.
Yes.
So there you go.
There you go.
Dewey, I think, has also played Raw, so that's two up on Warm Boy. So, Through the Desert is the Reiner Knizia brilliant tiling game of the last years of the 20th century. And sure enough, it was commented both by Louis and by Dewey about the incredible economy of rules and the tremendous effect that one gets from them. We did not play with any of the modules from the new All-Play Edition. Dewey inquired after them, and I reminded myself about what they were, and I was reminded why I didn't have any interest in them, frankly. Some of them strike me as borderline offensive. And You actually pointed out something that I didn't know, which is that the all-play edition has a misprint on the board.
It does. Well, once you've set up, you'll realize that you have one extra token left for the Oasi. And then...
That's not the plural of Oasis.
And then you'll wonder why that is. Well, that's because they didn't print one down in the corner.
Yes. And you initially started looking for the crowdfunding updates, and the message that talked about the misprint on the board and the promise of replacement boards, the picture they included was singularly unhelpful at identifying what the issue was or what the replacement was.
Yeah, it was a picture of the board. It said, hey, there's a misprint on this board somewhere.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yes. So we found the necessary information on BoardGameGeek, and the good news is that most of the time, unless that area is cordoned off by a caravan of camels, the space is always going to be occupied either by the token or a camel. So we just put a dot with a Sharpie and there you go. We're good.
And done.
And I'll probably do the same with my copy. That having been said, I have yet to have a bad copy of Through the Desert. You could theoretically replace the pastel camels with cardboard tokens. And part of me recognizes that that would probably be the responsible choice. But no, always plastic camels.
Always.
And so the all-play edition, other than that misprint, is perfectly serviceable. And the tininess of the box is, it's a little bit too much. But I do appreciate the economy of scope.
And it was enjoyed by Dewey so much that he insisted on we play a second time. So we played a game twice in a row, which is very uncommon.
We almost never do that. And Through the Desert is sufficiently fast, especially playing with five. With five, the game is going to go at a pretty good clip. And we did not encounter the one strange interaction that you sometimes have with five, because controlling the length of the game and determining when the game should end is of great consequence. In the second game we played, we almost ran afoul of it, because in five players, every player is not playing with one of the five colors. And sometimes you're in a position where it's like, well, I would like to end the game, and we're almost out of grape camels, but I don't play in grape, so I can't do anything about that.
Yeah, either you don't have it or your grape is locked because it's five players, the map is so crowded.
Yes, that is also the other possibility. We had a spirited discussion about what flavors the new camel colors could be, and we have a number of alternatives. We're not 100% sure about red. It could be watermelon. It could be strawberry. I got moved off of cherry. I don't think it's cherry. It's not the right shade of color. The yellowish could be mango because it's slightly orange.
I don't know. Banana came in at the end there, and I really like the banana.
I don't know. Look, I'm pro-banana as well. I just don't know about that color. Detergent is still detergent, though. Yeah. That is definitely the case. The other shade of green we're leaning towards apple, and I think that works out well. Anyway, these are important things in Through the Desert, and one of the great aspects of the hobby that is underappreciated. Through the Desert.
By Reiner Knizia. Put out by Allplay. At least the newest edition.
Played a game of Cthulhu Death May Die Fear of the Unknown. So this is the new expandalone from Kulmanirnoth. They ran a sort of, I would call it a Season 2 Kickstarter, but Season 2 was already launched in the previous Kickstarter, and this Kickstarter is Seasons 3 and 4, so yeah. And the amount of content, as you might imagine, is huge. The stack of new characters is massive.
It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. And unlike a lot of other Kulmanirnoth projects where there's a raft of new special characters, the most glaring example, I think, is Project Elite. The character selection in Project Elite is very dodgy and uneven. And a lot of the special monsters and things, even like games like Ankh, I adore Ankh. It was our game of the year. Fabulous game, but some of the monsters are not as good as others. And when I saw the huge stack of new characters in Death May Die, Fear of the Unknown, I was a little nervous, because every character in Death May Die has three skills. Two of them are pulled from a common pool, and the third one is unique to each character. We already had a very large number from Seasons 1 and 2. So I'm like, how could they possibly... I think they did a really good job. We've only seen a number of them, but looking through the characters, some of them seem really cool.
It's true, but why would they? When you have such a huge number to choose from already, why do you need so many more?
Because they're there.
True.
So I see. Here's the thing.
Stretch goals.
Yeah. So I have. So here's what used to be the case. I'm going to walk you through it. Okay. I used to have an unreasonable number of things. Right.
Gotcha.
And then they made more things, and then my unreasonable number is not enough things. That's how it works.
Like when you roll a 6 to a 1, it resets it. Like, so many. You Gandhied it from being peaceful, it got aggressive.
I would say more like the Pakunk from Star Control 2. No. Here, I rolled my 6, right?
Gotcha.
And that's a great number. And then someone rolls up with their Formula Day version and pulls out the custom D30. That's what went on.
Oh.
And so then I needed to go get a D50. That's what's going on. Otherwise, I don't have enough things.
More things.
Yeah. Anyway, all of that having been said, in all seriousness, Cthulhu Death May Die lives or dies by its scenarios, and the scenarios have been mostly excellent. Some of them, especially the ones with fire, I'm not as big a fan of, and new scenarios are cool. You don't need them, though, because there's a certain level of replayability because it's entirely modular. You pick your great old one, you pick your scenario, and that combination gives you the set of mythos cards and monsters that you're going to be fighting, and so it's not entirely different if you replay a scenario with a different great old one, but it is substantially different, and I appreciate that. So we played the first scenario of Season 3. And it was called Top of the Morning, but with morning spelt with a U. Do you get it? It's a wordplay, Walker.
So clever.
Yeah. It was Irish AF. All the Irish stereotypes were there. And I was initially a little unimpressed, but they did do some cool things. Like, for example, my character found a flask from which they could drink and heal all their stress. And then if they ended their turn in the pub, they could refill their flask. Like, great. It was neat, and there were a number of little touches and flourishes like that that I actually appreciated it. You're trying to assemble a jury together to undo a historical evil in the form of a witch trial that executed someone who was innocent, and there was another event card that took one of those jurors, and you know they were already in the village square ready for the trial to begin. One of them pops off to the pub. You have to go get them again. It's a whole thing.
And the fact that you have to convince them.
Yes. You have to convince them with evidence like, hey, I've got these bloody teeth in this ritual dagger. See? Like, yeah, great. I'll vote however you want. Just leave me alone. And the pulpy nonsense that is Cthulhu Death May Die remains aggressively enjoyable. During the actual game, there's not a whole lot of fiddly nonsense, despite the fact that you get a fair amount of scenario variety, a fair amount of monster variety, and things like that. I have not quite settled in on the storage solution for the new contents yet, and so consequently it's a little bit cumbersome in that sense. But honestly, the variety of characters, the variety of scenarios, I'm still a massive fan. I don't know how much work was done on seasons 3 and 4 of the original designers, Rob Davio and Eric Lang, or whether this was mostly a Marco Portugal joint. He is the new one credited for the Fear of the Unknown content, but I don't know. So having played the original scenarios of Cthulhu Death May Die, very much looking forward to new ones. I'm hoping that we are going to get something half so absurd as strapping explosives up to farm animals so as to blow up UFOs. Time will tell. I was very pleased.
It's a high bar.
It is a very high bar. We love this series. It's one of our favorite kind of silly dice-chucking bits of nonsense cooperative plastic things. That's a genre of game. I think Board Game needs to put that down in those words as a
exactly
category. And so when there's more stuff that's so scenario-driven, and with a company whose output lately has been so thoroughly uneven, I was a little trepidatious about Fear of the Unknown. But one play in, I have to say, it's very much of the same tone, tenor, and quality as the previous Death May Die content. So I'm very, very pleased. That is Cthulhu Death May Die, Fear of the Unknown.
Those are the games we played this week. Now a quick break to pay some bills.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, we like Voidfall.
We do.
So why not another game in the same world as Voidfall? Revenant. This is designed by neither of the designers from Voidfall, different designer, Alan Kirkaby. Ian O'Toole is going to be doing the art. This is coming out by Mind Clash Games. It seems like it's just sort of like a worker placement, everyone flee from the tyranny type game from Mind Clash. So maybe since Voidfall sometimes didn't hit with some people, it was very big.
Yes.
Maybe Revenant will hit differently.
Yeah, I don't know. The things that I enjoyed primarily about Voidfall were not the Ian O'Toole art or even so much the setting. And so when I got this announcement in my email inbox, because of course, the moment you even so much as glance at a crowdfunding page, Mind Clash has you forever.
It's true.
As does every other publisher sending you endless updates of whatever. Mind Clash has become a wait-and-see company for their side releases. Their main big funding stuff, the only major misstep they've had is...
Septima and Perseverance.
Thank you. I couldn't remember the name of the dinosaur game. Not enough dinosaur. Perseverance and Septima we didn't really like, but other than that, they've been really solid. So for me, it's mostly the designer I check first. And so far, the output of Nigel Buckle and David Certze, I mean, they've done Imperium and they've done Voidfall, two Game of the Year contenders as far as I'm concerned. So anything they do in the immediate future, I'm going to snap up like crazy. And so when I first saw it, it's like, hey, more of the Voidfall universe. I'm like, great, tell me more. Oh, no. Nothing against Alan Kirkaby. I just never played anything by him. He designed a game about itchy monkeys. It could be good. I don't know. But suffice to say that the way they're pitching this is like, hey, it's just like did you love Voidfall? Well, then here's Revenant. It's like the things I liked about Voidfall.
Yeah. So it'd be just like Azul, right? Here's a new game. It has Azul in the name. I'm sure it's exactly the same.
I venture to say even the Azul games have more connective tissue because at least there they have those little tiles.
True. Mark, Choir came out before I was born. I'm sure it's still relevant and popular. It's coming out again by Renegade Games.
People do like Choir.
It's true. So if you want to spend $100 to get the newest edition of Choir, it's coming out for you.
Choir has had a number of editions, and I don't think anyone is really willing. It's weird. They all appeal to radically different sets of tastes. The original wooden one may be the best way to get everyone on board. It might be the way to meet everyone in the middle, but there are those who love the minimalist aesthetic of just the cardboard versions, and then there are the people who will not shut up about the Avalon Hill edition with all plastic everywhere, and it looks like the Renegade version is going to be not quite as absurd as the Avalon Hill edition, but definitely on a spectrum towards that.
So here we go.
What are your thoughts on Choir, Walker?
I know, I've played it twice, but both times quite a while ago. It definitely seems like an older game.
Yeah, a little too luck dependent. I like a lot about it, but if you're not involved in the early stock payouts, you might as well call it a day.
Yeah, you'll run out of money a little early.
And besides, I think everything that Choir does well, Stevenson's Rocket does too.
It's true.
Anyway, but it's good to see it back in print. There are people who genuinely love Choir.
For the people that want it,
100%.
At least it will be available now.
100%. There are lots of games that get reprinted that I don't like, and I figure, what? Why? But there are some games that I'm not a fan of, like Choir, like Nexus Ops, for example, where it gets reprinted, and I say, oh, that makes sense. A lot of people like it. A lot of new people would probably like to be exposed to it. Good. This episode is a multiple of 5. We will thus acknowledge the existence of our Patreon. We have a Patreon. New bonus content all the time. A tremendous back catalog of bonus content. Patreon-exclusive Discord. And you get to support free and independent media. So if you are at all inclined, please do drop us a visit at patreon.com/svag. We would love to have you as a supporter.
All sorts of different levels. Mark does a huge amount of work putting out extra stuff like Bloat, Sizzler. We do a crowdfunding episode every other week. There's free games to be had at certain tiers.
Yeah, please take our games.
Yes, for the love of God, please.
Please, please take our games.
We can barely get into the studio. Take the games. They're free.
Well,
you have to pay for shipping.
You have to pay for shipping. That is the news and why it doesn't matter. We now move on to our feature game, which is Andromeda's Edge. Andromeda's Edge was fulfilled this year pursuant to successful crowdfunding by Cardboard Alchemy, designed by Luke Laurie and Maximus Laurie. Andromeda's Edge is a spiritual successor to Dwellings of Eldervale, which was designed by Luke Laurie, and now brings it into space, which is the next thing you do after fantasy.
Obviously.
Fantasy space, then either pirates or zombies, your pick. But then, of course, you
or
have
Vikings, you know.
Yeah, Vikings is an option too. But of course, you can have Vikings, pirates, and or zombies in your fantasy or science fiction game anyway, so you can just cut out the middle person. So, Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Andromeda's Edge?
Well, I've been told, and we sort of talked about it, that you're supposed to be building these developments, and that gets you points.
Yes.
But I think you're too busy. You're too busy collecting resources, building ships, upgrading those ships, fighting and repairing those ships, putting out some modules. Don't forget those, because you've got 5 tracks that you also have to go up. And maybe if you can dodge the raiders, events, and random tactics cards, maybe you'll build one of those developments.
Okay. Andromeda's Edge. Let's first talk about Dwellings of Eldervale a little bit.
Yes.
Just for context, all right?
I did go back over the rule book.
Of Dwellings of Eldervale?
Yes.
Yeah. So I thoroughly dislike Dwellings of Eldervale. My recollection is that you're slightly more pro.
I have kept it because I'm interested in playing it more, yes.
Yes. And my strong objections were premised on the... A lot of... To be a very, very general level, there's often a problem when you design something that has a lot of Euro trappings in terms of economic elements and or going up tracks, and then say, hey, but you know what would be cool? Let's graft a fighting system on top of it. You can make really interesting hybrids, and there are tons of really interesting hybrids, some of them done by Matt Gertz, a lot of them done by Eric Lang. You know, there's ways to hybridize these issues. There's some work from the French developers. Games like Senji are really good examples of how to merge these things together. But there are a number of pitfalls. And one of them is that your economic model can easily be disrupted by someone coming and kicking sand all over your face because combat tends to trump economy, right? It's hard to farm when someone's running through with raiders, as a general rule. And I felt that one of the many problems that Dwellings of Eldervale had was precisely that. In order to build the eponymous dwellings, everything needed to arrive in the precise constellation. And if any weird fight happened and you were not in control of when you were fighting very often, then you one of those things could be dislodged and then you don't get to do it and resetting up would take forever. When Andromeda's Edge was launched on crowdfunding, the rational thought of Mark's mind showed up and said, Mark, save your money. This ain't gonna... No, you have no reason to believe that this is gonna be any good. But then I saw that there was sort of a design remit. There was like a list of things that they wanted to do to differentiate Andromeda's Edge from Dwellings of Eldervale. And it was more or less listing my chief problems with Dwellings of Eldervale. I'm not suggesting that they were cribbing from me. These were very common objections. So I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. And here we are.
And they did. They fundamentally changed the combat system. In the end, it washes out to the same sort of result.
Exactly.
I mean, like, it's
fundamentally different, but ultimately the same.
The resolution of it is the same.
Yes.
How you get to that, they did an interesting way where you'd keep re-rolling dice because you'd have like a low threshold that you'd keep re-rolling.
They've made the combat results less arbitrary.
Yes.
Not infrequently in a game of Dwellings of Eldervale, you'd show up with your, you know, three warriors, a wizard, and a dragon, roll a four and three threes, and somebody wanders in with a farmer and rolls a six, and they win.
Yes.
And now they've made it so that your minimum die result is the number of units you have in the combat, and you keep re-rolling until such time as you get to that lower level.
And some of the units give you more dice.
Yes, of course. That was true in Dwellings as well.
And so they didn't do too badly with the combat, other than the fact that if someone focuses on combat and becomes almost unstoppable, then they can cause a lot of problems. Because even if you want to get to a spot, it's like, oh, all I only have to do is, you know, deal with this raider. Maybe I have a chance there. But if that person that has focused on combat is anywhere close,
yeah,
they can now just say, no, I think I'm going to be part of that combat. And then just, you know, wash out any advantage you thought you might have had.
And this interacts with the fundamental worker placement. At least, I will say this, credit where credit is due. When you go to a worker spot that's going to start a massive conflagration combat, even if you know that to be the case, you still get to do the action on that space. That's the good thing. That part's fine. The difficulty comes in later. I'll start talking about developments later because that's one of my key objections. I feel, though, and this is going to be something I'm going to bring up again in other contexts of Andromeda's Edge, the combat resolution mechanism is an improvement that I feel reveals how fundamentally shallow the game was in the first place. In other words, they've sanded off a lot of the hard edges, and consequently we have something that's no longer janky. It is merely boring. So I show up with my five ships, or my four ships, or whatever. My combat results are plus a million. Okay, the fight's going to go the way we all think it's going to go, right? And we end up having a strangely laborious combat resolution mechanism where we roll. Or you could just cut to the chase, and it's very frequently the case, the combatants can just look at it and say, no, you win. Stop rolling. No, seriously, stop rolling. You've won. You won 5 years ago. And it's a little bit more under your control than it was in Dwellings in many ways, but it makes it largely pro forma. Then there are the diplomacy cards. Oh my goodness, the diplomacy cards.
The tactics cards.
Well, the tactics cards in general are an issue. But so one of the aspects that I thought was going to be cool in the combat, and this is one of the design remits, is some ships now have shields. And so they lose a fight, and they're still around. They still sit there. But here's the thing. if you desperately need, if you're going to have a game with combat and you're going to talk about how, you can interact with your fellow players, sometimes there's a virtue to this. You have to be able to go at and target somebody and be able to possibly affect them. Well, if you can only force a combat once or twice and their ships are still around afterwards, there's nothing you can do to them. You can't show up in the same space again. So that shielded ship makes the consequence of combat largely irrelevant. Again, they've sanded off all the edges. Diplomacy cards, I thought, this will give some opportunity for people who are not particularly strong in combat or who desperately want to avoid a certain fight to be able to finesse the results and an extremist find someone. No, like the diplomacy cards, so many of them say the fight just doesn't happen. And now you've got people with ships in a system they didn't want to be in the first place. They only showed up there so as to be able to win a fight. Maybe they needed to win the fight for their victory conditions. And there's just a card that says, no, we're not going to have a fight. And the effects of the diplomacy cards range all the way from, there's no fight, I have to pay you. Those are the ones I prefer. All the way to, there's no fight, you have to pay me. Which is just nonsense. Anyway, all over the map, and it makes things feel very, very blunted.
Now, why fighting was bad in Dwellings of Eldervale were if your units got damaged and you recalled them, you wouldn't be able to do all the fun stuff, like trigger all the things. This happens again. The problem is they've made all of those things that you can trigger way more powerful.
Yes.
So if you're losing your ships, then you don't get to trigger those. They did make it a little bit easier to trigger them because you're making rows of these. So once you've got all your ships out, then one of your actions is to recall all your ships and use these ships to trigger all of these modules that you'll be putting out. And all you really need to do is trigger one module in a row and you can use energy to trigger the rest. So that's kind of handy as long as you have the energy.
Yes. And energy is, I think, reasonably well calibrated. You can get it without too much difficulty, but it's seldom the case that you have so much that you never care. Sometimes you might. And this highlights the most interesting aspect of Dwellings, Andromeda's Edge, as well as another game that I'll refrain from mentioning for a little bit, so I don't just say it 20 times in the context of every minute of this discussion. The tableau building is the most interesting part of these games. Dwellings of Eldervale didn't give you enough chance to mess around with the tableau building. You didn't get enough cards, and you didn't get enough of the tokens that made the cards interesting, because you can slot in tokens to cards, and you might have a really, really good effect in any of these games where pay a cost and you get something amazing. Well, the cost you can slot in by acquiring a token. Oh, you get that token of that resource that you tend to have a lot of. Oh, I make the cost something I'm really good at paying. There you go. You've helped build your engine and now you're in a good spot. Or sometimes it's just as simple, and frankly, it is just as simple as there's this slot. Slot in whatever you want there. When this module gets activated, you'll get whatever that slot is. So rather than cashing the thing in once, you get to cash it in every time you run your engine. I didn't feel like I got to do that enough in Dwellings of Eldervale. In Andromeda's Edge, to their credit, they've doubled down on that. You get far more modules than you did cards in old Dwellings, and you get to mess around with that far more. It's the most interesting part of the game. It is incredibly time-consuming, and it is 100% multiplayer solitaire. The most time-consuming turn in Andromeda's Edge is when someone pulls their ship back and someone's like, okay, well, this gives me the two ice, and then this, I can activate this with energy and I get the titanium. And then my recourse now is like, is this going to affect the board? No? I'm going to take my turn. And it's not that I'm frustrated with them. I'm mostly frustrated with the game because when I do the same thing, when I'm pulling back in the ship, it's like, this goes here and I get this. This goes here and I get this. This goes here and I get this. It's a lot. It's a lot of upkeep.
Yeah, because it's not always just getting resources. It's also, this will let me build a ship. What ship do I want to build? Well, I'm short this. Well, then I'm gonna have to pull back another ship to get that resource. Well, I don't have another ship. Well, I'll pull. I won't do that.
Yeah,
I'll put it over here and repair a ship instead. So now that'll give me the extra ship that I need to do that. And I shimmy this around, and I have to make sure I engage both sides of the two modules. That will give me the bonus in the middle. Anyway, yes, I won't keep going on. Like you said, it takes a long time, and makes the kills the flow of the game, which is not terrible. Like, I've heard nightmares of 4-player games or even 3-player games taking 4 to 3 hours. All of our games took 2 or less hours.
Now, admittedly, we were mostly playing with people who'd played Dwellings before, and we were mostly driving the pace. But yeah, it can drag, especially once you start worrying about the interaction of raiders and everything else that might happen through any given placement. And especially since Here's another thing that Andromeda's Edge is I don't even know to what extent this is a criticism. It's mostly just weird. I don't ever think it's good in a game design, but I question how big a detriment it is. It does a very good job at obscuring what the victory conditions are. Not in a way of making them opaque. This is not like a coin game or something like that, where it's like, how do I win again? It's just that, very much like Dwellings of Eldervale, in Andromeda's Edge, what you want to do is you want to go up tracks and build developments. That's it. Everything else is noise. Everything else is a rounding error. Yeah, you get a point here, a point there from other stuff, and by all means, go and pursue those things. But you want to build your development. So if you're not spending resources towards the ultimate end, like, oh, I can get out this other ship, I can get this toy, I can get this customization thing. No. You're wasting your time. The problem is those things are cool. So the fundamental fact that there's all this other stuff and it's easy to get down a cul-de-sac of stuff that's weird and doesn't advance your victory conditions is bad enough. But the thing is that all these extra toys and all these other new things, spending resources on new ships, no, get ship upgrades instead. Go up the brown track. The brown track really matters a lot because there you get a cooler ship and you get it for free. And if you're not paying for the ship, that's resources you can spend towards the developments, which is how you win.
Yeah, which, like I said, that's why I like about the tracks in Dwellings of Eldervale are pretty basic. I like the ones here because they all give you, like you just said, extra stuff as you go up these tracks. There's, like you said, the ship upgrades, the development levels. Like you said, you have to build the developments and then become worth more points the further up the tracks you go. There's supremacy tokens, discovery tokens, things that will increase your hand size and let you draw right up to your full thing. So there's reasons to go up all of the tracks.
I don't know. The tracks are awfully tracky. I'm not.
They are. I'm not saying that they're great. I'm saying they're better than they were.
I'm not even sure that's true. Because at least the benefit of a simple track system like Dwellings of Eldervale is it makes it very, very clear this is just a means to an end. This is just your scoring position at the end of the game with respect to these various things. Andromeda's Edge, the fact that all the tracks are asymmetrical and do different things, can encourage the sense of confusion and missing the forest for the trees because there's all this other stuff that's, ooh, I can get my hand limit higher. It's like, not worth it. Go up the blue track if you've built blue developments. If you haven't built blue developments, ignore it. Same thing with the yellow track. It's just, that's one of the reasons why you see these games that take 3 to 4 hours. That these people, it's like, oh, I get to do all this stuff. It's like, yeah, you can, but you shouldn't.
Yeah, that's going to be my final point. I'll say it now, but it's not as though I'm done. Is that there are games in which you need to change your strategy. You need to be able to turn on a dime and do something else.
Yeah.
I feel as though that is all you're doing in this game. Is that someone will take the spot you need. Someone will take the module you wanted. Someone will build the development that you wanted in the spot that you wanted. Someone will be blocking where you need to go. You constantly, every time it's your turn, you're going to have to do something that you didn't want to do anyway. So you're constantly changing your momentum.
Yeah, I guess that's true, but mostly, I find that so many elements of the game design, particularly the asymmetry, reveal, I think, a common design problem with respect to designing asymmetry. Well-done asymmetry expands your available options and toolkits. The asymmetry that I dislike more is the one that narrows your focus. Let me give two examples. And again, this may be crowdfunding cruft. This may be other problems. But I'm going to talk about the refugees and the dragons because, yeah, there are asymmetric player powers because, of course, there are. The refugees, they get to go up the battle track every time they win a battle and every time they lose a battle. Again, it just, everything gets blunted. Everything gets sanded down. So they just want to get in fights and then they don't care what happens in the fights. Similarly, other players who are at the table don't have a way to impede them up this track. They're going to rocket to the top of this right track no matter what happens. I've seen them in 3 games now and it worked the same way every time. The only thing you can really do to blunt the progress of the refugees is just avoid fighting with them, which is difficult to do in the first place because they can just pick a fight with you. And also just means you're not getting points either if you need to go up the battle track. Another example is the dragons. The dragons have a power that's useful during the game, I will freely own, but also they double their vault bonus for credits. So what they're telling you is A, go up the yellow track, which is the one that gives you a vault bonus in the first place, and B, don't spend your credits, or at least make sure you have 5 at the end of the game. So your track has basically been picked for you. That's the one you should go up.
Well, they did that in Dwellings as well. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but I mean, it's the same sort of thing. I guess you can deny them that development, right? If you know, someone's playing the refugees, then just don't make sure they do not build a red development in order to double down on those points.
I guess. But who knows how many planets are going to be available. Yeah. So normally there's going to be a random setup of planets. And normally it doesn't matter. But again, if you're the dragons, if the dragons are in the game and there aren't any yellow planets are the planets where you build the yellow developments. And the yellow developments are the ones that are worth more points if you're high up the yellow track. Well, now you're at cross purposes. It's kind of like the situation I identified with Planet Unknown, where these two things, these two random elements have conjoined together to make sure that you can't fulfill your victory conditions the way that other people can. It just, I generally get the impression in Andromeda's Edge that the systems are not working together in a very, very coherent way. And ultimately, the extent to which Dwellings of Elderel was janky has been shifted to now make it feel mostly pointless. And I don't, it's weird, I don't hate Andromeda's Edge. I just mostly feel like it's a question of much ado about nothing, and it mostly makes me feel tired at the end of the game.
Yeah, I think we covered mostly everything I want to talk about. Just raiders. They had these giant monsters and dwellings. Like, yep. I know we keep referring to dwellings, but they are very
They're very similar games, yes.
So the monsters can only attack you if you place units adjacent. Now raiders have range. So now they cover some of them cover much bigger radius. So you want to go there, which is fine. You think, okay, all I have to do is fight that one raider, but then no other people can join the fight. That's where I've already talked about comes into problems.
And so, very much like the monsters in Dwellings of Eldervale, I find there's a very unhelpful, unsatisfying arc with respect to the raiders in Andromeda's Edge. At the beginning of the game, they can blow you out of the sky. And then somewhere near the middle of the game, or maybe even earlier case depending, they switch to becoming borderline irrelevant. And so they either lock down an area of the board where if you dare to go there, you'll be destroyed, or they're just this utter extra aspect of nuisance upkeep that doesn't really matter.
Yeah, or they force a battle where you lose your ships, and the person that concentrated in battle will get a benefit because they killed the raider.
Yeah.
Game length is interesting. It's much like Root and or these other newer games that have been coming out. They set a scoring threshold, and as soon as someone passes that, the game will end. That is also different than Dwellings. And they have these very interesting leader pieces.
Yeah. The components... So, raiders. It's a shame that the raiders are often so irrelevant, because the raider pieces in the deluxe version of Andromeda's Edge are some of the best spaceships that I've seen in a long time. They're great. They're full of personality. They're really cool looking. The player pieces are fine for the most part. In comparison, they're much less impressive. But everything is like sculpted representational plastic, except for the leader pieces. And when they're in a development, they look kind of cool. But when they're just on the board ready to be snatched up, or when they're on your player board ready to be used, they're these weird peg looking things.
They're like a widget.
Exactly. Like, no, these are your leaders. Like, what? Okay. It's very strange.
Like, if it could have been like Lords of Hellas, where they're actual leader pieces and then they put little pedestals on the development so you can sort of stick them on.
Yeah.
So there was many things they could have done. This way that they looked very odd.
It's true. Have you played a game called Cryo Walker?
Cryo, never heard of it.
Yeah.
What do you do?
So Cryo is by Luke Laurie and by Jolly. And honestly, it has the cool engine building. It has the cool, I bring my pieces back, I get to run my engine. But it's faster. The player interaction is less, much less than in Dwellings or Andromeda's Edge. But what player interaction is consequential.
Yeah,
exactly. It's rewarding and consequential. And it's not a sort of, oh, you don't get to go there, oh, I'm going to blow up all your stuff anymore. There's area majority competition for scoring, as well as a subtle element of tempo influence based on where you're going to be. Cryo is a medium light Euro that has the best clever bits of both Dwellings and Andromeda's Edge, comes in at half the time, a third the rules density, and for my taste, is twice as good. So, Cryo.
Yeah, I still enjoy Dwellings more. Still enjoy my planes of Andromeda's Edge. Would prefer to play Dwellings, but in the end...
Okay, so what is it that's appealing to you? Because here you are matching me step for step in all these complaints. But you're like, I still enjoy playing it. What are you getting out of it?
I think it's just the individual player powers and how they interact with each other. And they had a dungeon system in Dwellings that I find interesting. And a little bit of that, you know, making your own little tableau. Even though it's not as rewarding as it is in Cryo, it's still interesting in a way.
So it's playing around with the different toys and seeing the different effects and things like that. Sure. I would probably be... I'm perfectly willing to do that in other games as well. I'd probably be closer to there, especially in the context of Andromeda's Edge, if I didn't feel like so much of it was distraction and noise.
Yeah,
right?
There's so much.
Because you win the game by going up tracks and building developments. And all these other powers, many of them are just window dressing, not actually helping you advance your condition. And I remember it was about halfway through my first game of Andromeda's Edge where I had that same realization that I've had during a number. Whenever I play Dwellings of Eldervale, it's always the same thing. It's like halfway through, I remember, oh yeah, that's how you actually get points. All this other stuff doesn't matter nearly as much. And so when Andromeda's Edge rolled around, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, fine. And then you just go do the boring thing over and over. And I find it disappointing. As I say, Andromeda's Edge fixed a lot of the issues I had with Dwellings of Eldervale, all to just make me see with greater transparency that I think the fundamental design conceit is ill-conceived. Andromeda's Edge! That's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate your spending the time with us, and we hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.